This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. On November 30th, 1984, David Jacobson arrived in Beirut to head up the medical center at the American University. On May 28th, 1985, he was kidnapped and held hostage for 17 months. Jacobson has written a book about his ordeal called Hostage, My Nightmare in Beirut. Jacobson writes that he and the other hostages lived in a basement prison, stripped to their shorts, blindfolded, and limited to a diet of poorly cooked subsistence fare, requiring permission to attend to the most basic personal needs, and under the threat of imminent execution for reasons beyond their control. On November 2, 1986, Jacobson was released. He learned later that he'd been part of an arms for hostages deal arranged by Oliver North, which would later come to light during the Iran-Contra investigation. When David Jacobson decided to move to Beirut, he had no idea what was in store for him.
I took a trip over in July of 1984 to see with my own eyes and to confirm what I had heard. Apparently the war was over, peace was at hand, all the parties were talking. I didn't hear any signs of war. When I arrived at the airport, they made certain that in the drive to the university, I didn't see any of the major signs of war. I had assurances from the Shiite militia and from the Druze militia and from the Christians that if I didn't get involved in any local politics, I'd be safe. I was doing humanitarian work, being the administrator of the hospital, and they wanted me. Apparently, the university had checked with the State Department. State Department had encouraged the employment of an American administrator because of the significant support of the university by the Agency for International Development.
You describe a shootout in the lobby of the hospital where you were the administrator. You were nearly caught in the crossfire. When did things begin to heat up again?
Well, that shootout was actually, nobody ever really thought of that as being a fight between the major militias. That was a little struggle between two small groups of Shiites, maybe a half a dozen men in each group, and they met in our lobby. They had an argument. They started to shoot.
Did that seem unusual?
Yes, it did. It was the probably the worst violation of the university and the medical center in the whole 10-year civil war. People were shocked because the American University of Beirut Medical Center was an island of safety, island of security. We took no sides in the struggle. We provided care and education for all people, regardless of their religious affiliation. It was an island of safety, and for a shootout to occur in our lobby, irregardless of the fact that it was just a small number of men, was a horrible crime. In fact, the Lebanese army was called out, and they assigned a company to provide protection for the medical center because they, too, were concerned for what had happened.
Well, did that make you feel that perhaps Beirut was a more dangerous place than you had come to believe?
Well, you get war-wise very quickly. The war was still many, many miles away, and this happened to be just a gang fight. These things happen in New York City and in Philadelphia, and you don't hear the people saying, I got to get out of town. There are more people that are murdered in the streets of Washington, D.C., or L.A., or Detroit, or Miami, than in West Beirut. So, when you're over there, you don't hear of what's happened. I tell people it was like being in the eye of the storm. The major storm had gone through, and things were relatively quiet. People did not talk about the war. They were all hopeful and optimistic that peace would be at hand. What we didn't know was that the backside of the storm was going to come and hit us. We should have known, but we didn't.
There were Westerners that were captured, I believe, while you were still working in Beirut. Did that make you any more nervous? Or did you think that I might be next?
No, I never thought I'd be next. I never thought I was going to be kidnapped. When there were three Americans that were taken, but I really don't recall Ben Weir's kidnapping, any publicity about that. The only kidnapping that I was really aware of was of Terry Anderson, and that was a brief report there and on local radio and on the newspaper. One day, it quickly was no longer the lead item. People did not talk about it. There was feeling that he was kidnapped off of a public tennis court and that he shouldn't have been out there and that... Which wasn't the case. There was misinformation given. But people just didn't talk about it. because they had lived with, you know, this problem for years and years and years.
How were you captured?
I was walking from the campus where I resided to the medical center where I worked. And it was the only public exposure was at the intersection, a small intersection, about three car widths. There where Daniel Bliss and JFK Boulevard come together. I was walking with the chief of OBGYN, and there were a couple hundred people in the intersection. It was jammed with cars, students walking into the campus, students walking into that entrance for the medical center. There were armed policemen at the gates to the campus, and there was one armed Lebanese soldier about 10 yards from me. A van pulled up. A gunman came running first and he cut us off and started to fight with the doctor. The doctor turned his back into him and was pushing him away. Two gunmen grabbed me from the back and were trying to force me into a van. I kicked at them. I hit them with my elbows. I tried to get away. Finally, in a brief period of time, may have been 1, 2, 3 minutes, the gunman fighting with the doctor took his pistol and fired two rounds into the pavement, then put the gun at the doctor's head, indicating he was going to kill the doctor if I continued to resist. At that point, I said, okay, I'll go, and I got in the van, which I was pistol-whipped at that point, bound, gagged, blindfolded, stripped of my valuables, my belt, my tie, my shoes, my wallet, and I was put in a compartment under the floor of the van and taken to the first place of interrogation.
I'm speaking with David Jacobson. He was director of the American University of Beirut's Medical Center. This was in 1984 and 1985. He was taken hostage in Beirut in the spring of 1985, and we're talking about his captivity and the conditions under which he lived. And he was held hostage for 17 months. Did you feel you had any control over your environment? Now, you write about the fact that they certainly controlled your bathroom behavior, the most kind of basic kind of behavior. Were there other parts of your life where you were able to kind of wrestle some semblance of control over?
Well, we actually, they denied us every freedom except the freedom to think and the freedom to pray. And we have those two freedoms. There are many, many coping mechanisms that you can use. I say that hostages survive because there are about seven coping mechanisms that anyone can use to overcome adversity or a crisis. And the first was that we were all religious men before we were kidnapped, and so a strong belief in God is a source of strength in this type of problem. We also had great beliefs in our own innate strength. We knew that we were educated, we were experience in living in the Middle East. We had some understanding of the Arab culture and the world of Islam. We also had the ability to think about our loved ones, which gave us some source of comfort and strength and a purpose to survive. Every one of us, and I would think Terry Anderson today and Tom Sutherland, who have been held almost the same length of time, an excruciating 6.5 years, none of us ever, ever really thought that our adversity would never end favorably. We always had faith that good things were going to happen. And there's an acronym, EGBOC. Everything's going to be okay. And that kept us going. We also maintained the ability to focus and become task-oriented and use our calculating powers. And we learned how to express our anger via appropriate self-assertion. We never pushed the guards too far. I used a lot of sarcasm with the guards, with a big smile on my face. Ben Weir got out, and he told my family he used to shudder when the things I would say at the guards, with a big smile on my face. I was used sarcasm you can't believe, but I expressed my anger that way.
One of the other things that you did was to carry on many political fights with Terry Anderson, who I guess you could consider your political opposite.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, that made us survive, because what we were doing there was we were intellectually keeping alive. And Terry is very bright. I used to kid him. He was bright but not brilliant. But he's very brilliant and very bright man. But we could take any side of any arguments. We were sophists. And we would argue about things that were ridiculous. We weren't arguing against one another. We weren't adverse. We were keeping our minds alert. We could express our frustration in our argument and do things and say things that we couldn't say to our captors. And that was one of the coping mechanisms.
Would you almost say it's a kind of ritual argument that you were having in terms of how you can create the passage of time through rituals?
Oh, absolutely. And I know I was told, heard that one of the released hostages, I think it may have been Brian Keenan, that Terry was pacing around the cell looking for somebody to argue with. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I have deep admiration for Terry, and I think the fact that we could disagree on things was a source of strength for both of us and source of survival. In fact, I kid that I'm never going to go to hell because I've already been there. I was chained for 17 months with a journalist who was a liberal Democrat from upstate New York who believed the public had a right to know anything and everything. And I'm a moderate Republican with a social conscience from Orange County, California, hospital administrator who believes passionately in the rights of confidentiality and privacy. And if that was hell for me, can you imagine what it was for poor Terry?
Well, you could keep that conversation going for many, many months. Did you have plans for escape at all? Did you entertain realistic plans? And were there moments in time where you might have been able to escape?
Every day of my life as a hostage, I thought about escape. I tried to prepare myself continually for that. I did 600 push-ups a day in sets of 60. I did a minimum of 600 sit-ups a day in sets varying from 100 to 150 or whatever. Whenever I became very angry with my kidnappers, I would, just like an old basic training, I'd say, get down, Dave, and give me 50 or give me 100. I knew I wasn't getting meat protein to build my muscles. I was doing the very best I could to keep my upper body in condition. In the event that I ever had an opportunity, I would only have one. I'd have to make advantage of it. In fact, I practiced garroting so that in the event I ever had a chance to stop a guard, I'd have to do it fast and without his making noise. I never had the real close I had one opportunity to do that, but I was in no condition to pull it off because of the of all the olive oil I had been fed, and it was working on my stomach.
Well, you spent a fair amount of time trying to just get to the bathroom, right?
Oh, yes.
What news of the world leaked in?
Well, you know, it's amazing when you're kept like blind rabbits in a box how you can hear what's going on. Once one of the leaders of the Hezbollah came to see us, I guess to verify we're still alive, and we talked to him about, you know, you can feed us and you'll keep our bodies alive. If you don't give us something for our minds, our intellectual spirit will wither and die, and that's a worse death than a physical death. And so they let us have a little radio, a shortwave radio, a Sony 7-bander. Not full-time, but for an hour or so, maybe twice a day, and then the French hostages would get it. And then the guards, who were not supposed to listen to rock and roll music, they were supposed to be religious fundamentalist Shiites, they would listen to their rock and roll. We would get some outside news. We would hear Voice of America. We would hear BBC.
What effect did press reports in this country have on your captivity? Was there evidence, for instance, that people that were holding you were reading American newspapers or watching American television or listening to American radio?
Hezbollah listens and watches to everything that goes on into this country. Anything that is said in this country on radio, on television, or in the print media, they see very, very quickly. In my book, I describe an incident that happened to me in which, at the time of Father Jenkel's release, I made a videotape. I ad-libbed. I stated that I gave my condolences to Bill Buckley, to the widow Bill Buckley and his daughters, mm-hmm. because I thought he had been married and had daughters. And the truth is, he had been married and he did have daughters. But the media told everybody that I had sent out a coded message.
They were reading your body language, I assume.
Right. And the media said that I had sent out a coded message because I had given my condolences to a widow and the daughter. A videotape was made of that message in this country. And it was sent to Lebanon. My captors showed it to me, and I was beaten very badly because of that. When I came home, you'll probably remember in the Rose Garden, I said to the media, in the name of God, back off. What you probably forget is that an irresponsible question was asked by a member of the White House press corps, and it so angered me that I pushed the president gently to one side, and I said, "Irresponsible speculation almost resulted in my death. Irresponsible speculation now could result in harm or death to the remaining hostages. I don't want that on my conscience. You should not have that on your conscience. And in the name of God, back off." Because it's one world. And there's a difference on how we perceive the media. Here, we doubt. We have questioned what we see, what we hear. Over there, the media is viewed with absolute integrity. If it's on television, it's got to be true.
I'm speaking with David Jacobs, and he was director of the American University of Beirut's Medical Center from 1984 until spring of 1985, when he was taken captive and held hostage for 17 months. He was held with Terry Anderson and Thomas Sutherland, who now mark their 6.5 years in captivity. Jacobson was released along with an American priest named Lawrence Jenko. He's written about his book. He's written about his years in Beirut and his thoughts on the American policy towards hostages. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. David Jacobson is my guest. He's written a book about his 17 months in captivity as a hostage in Beirut. The book is called Hostage, My Nightmare in Beirut. How were you actually released?
I was released for arms, as Reverend Ben Weir and Father Martin Jenko were. There was probably 1,000 TOW missiles that were sold to Iran for my release. And it became a part of the Iran-Contra scandal. And the Soviet Union knew of the arms for hostages. They wanted to protect their Sandinista allies in Nicaragua. They knew that funds or armaments were being supported provided the Contras. So the Soviet KGB leaked to the Syrians the arms for hostage deal, knowing full well what would happen in this country, the mass frenzy over this, and they did their best to support their, you know, their Sandinista allies.
When were you aware, then, of the details for your release?
Not until everything broke the month after I got out. In fact, I am a very fortunate man, because the story about arms for hostages was released the day after my freedom. The Syrians tried to release it basically the day before. If that had happened, I think Hezbollah would have been spooked, and I would still be there in my sixth year of captivity with Terry and Tom.
Do you think that your freedom was worth, and I think it's true, the subversion of U.S. foreign policy, and this was carried out by Oliver North and others, unbeknownst to George Shultz and others who were the architects, in part, of U.S. foreign policy?
I really am not certain as to that Ollie did this on his own. I'm personally quite convinced that Oliver North is a good, patriotic Marine colonel who follows orders, and that he was following orders, that people in the highest places in this country, including George Shultz, were fully aware of what was going on. The moral indignation over arms for hostages has always been a real surprise to me, because it is not illegal to provide arms or exchange for hostages. It's gone on for many, many times. In fact, about 200 years ago, we gave a completely equipped 36-gun frigate to release 115 American hostages held by the Barbary pirates.
But the U.S. government had banned sales of arms to Iran in 1979. After Iranians had seized the U.S. Sure. embassy in Iran, there was the Export Administration Act of 1979. The Reagan administration had added Iran to the list of terroristic countries in 1984. This was stated public foreign policy.
It is not unusual for our government to say one thing and act differently in private. I that's not unique to Reagan. That's probably gone on in every administration. I think if people want to become indignant over this, over arms for hostages, which is really a little drop in the ocean of arms sales, they should recognize that our wonderful country, and I don't mean that sarcastically, I love America. We are the number one arms dealer in the world. We provide more arms to the third world than any other nation. You don't hear any indignation by liberals or philosophers over that issue. And my kidnappers used to ask me, why do you bomb our children? Implying, why do you sell bombs to people who drop them on our innocent kids? I never had an answer for them.
Do you wrestle the? I mean, I realize that you didn't create the policy that created your freedom, but do you live comfortably with that? That's not a problem for you?
No, it's not. And I guess I can say that if you were held for as long as we were held under the conditions we were held, very frankly, you wouldn't care how you get out, except certain things you wouldn't do. You would never substitute your family in your place. Arms have been sold for hundreds of years. We still sell, you know, as I said before, this is a drop in the bucket. I think the real moral issue is, where do the Western democracies go? What role should they have? I think that is a more critical issue.
To what do you attribute the fact that there have been two more hostages released in the last week or so? Britisher John McCarthy, Edward Austin Tracy, who's an American. Why do you think they're being released, and what does that say about what's happening geopolitically in the Middle East?
Well, I think Iran finally wants to end the controversy. I don't think Iran really wants to have good relationships with the United States, but they need to have some type of rapport, economic rapport, with the European community. And so this was a way of starting that process. Everybody that comes out of the Middle East, out of Lebanon, it does so only on the orders of Iran, not Hezbollah. It's Iran. They're the great Satan of this whole thing.
Do you think the people that held you should be prosecuted?
Absolutely, Marty. I have dedicated my life to their apprehension. I will do everything I can to help our government, and I have been helping to identify them, to locate them. I'm looking forward to the day when they are caught, when they are put on trial, they are found guilty. And I hope to be there the day they are punished.
My guest has been David Jacobson. He's written about the 17 months that he was held hostage in Beirut in his new book, Hostage. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.